It's the time of year when we're all thinking about goals and priorities. Now is the time to plan your next trip. Whatever kind of travel fills you up, whether it's lounging on the beach, connecting with family and friends, or going on a foreign adventure, Expedia has the tools you need to plan a great trip. Download the Expedia app or visit Expedia.com to start planning. You do need to be a One Key member to use price tracking. Signing up is easy and free. Expedia, made to travel. We've all been there. You have a question about your credit card, you call the number for help, and can't get a hold of anyone. If you only had a Discover card. With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right, a real person. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I'm Oprah Winfrey. Welcome to Super Soul Conversations, the podcast. I believe that one of the most valuable gifts you can give yourself is time. Taking time to be more fully present. Your journey to become more inspired and connected to the deeper world around us starts right now.
Wow. Good to see you.
Good seeing you too.
I want to know if the dream you dreamed about having this career has already exceeded the dream, or are you living the dream? Did it look like this?
Exceeded the dream.
It exceeded the dream.
Exceeded the dream.
At 32 in a few days, you've exceeded the dream.
Yeah. Happy belated birthday, by the way.
Happy. Thank you.
No problem. No problem. Yes.
So now you got to dream a bigger dream.
Yes. I think over time, it's always been small success to small success to small success. Yeah. And you set these goals, and, you know, God's been giving me everything I want at an extreme rate. So it's like, okay, I got to recalibrate. I got to figure out what the next benchmark is. What's the next set of goals that I want to accomplish? So at 32, it's been
Are you about ready to dream a new dream?
I am.
Yeah.
I am.
I think that's so interesting because you say God's already exceeded any expectation that you had.
Yes.
And when you are starting out, you're just happy to get a role,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't understand, I guess, the process of acting and kind of, you know, the audition process.
Yeah.
Or, you know, when you first start out, you kind of are at the mercy of what you're casted for.
Yeah.
But when you get in a position to be able to say no to things, or because another thing with acting, you become way more famous and popular than you are financially stable. So
people think you're richer than you actually are.
Oh, for sure. I mean,
particularly in the beginning, right?
Especially in the beginning.
Especially in the beginning.
Coming from Newark, New Jersey, they see you on, you know, on a commercial or, you know, a print ad in the, you know, the Sunday newspaper, and they think you're a millionaire and you're good to go. Like, let me borrow this, let me borrow
and
that.
I was going to say, and do you find that people ask for money in direct proportion how much they think you have?
What they think you have.
Because I remember when I was working in Baltimore, everybody only needed 500.
Okay. And that was cool.
Yes,
that was
cool.
Management. That was cool. 500's cool.
And then as soon as I moved to Chicago, it was 5,000. And then now people would just call me up. I need $50,000.
Like, yeah.
Now. So, yes.
No, it's definitely been a thing. It's, you know how, you know, with the announcements and trades and everybody's announcing the things that we have going on, they equate that to a total different.
Yeah.
Financial situation.
But are you catching up now?
I'm being smart, you know, constantly reinvesting into the dream. You know, I've never been a really materialistic person, so I think my family has always been the first order of business. And then once I get that kind of taken care of, then it's like, all right.
Are you still living at home?
We're still living together.
Okay.
We're still living together.
That's good.
Yeah, we're together.
That works for you?
My mom in here somewhere.
Yeah.
There you go.
Your mom's in here.
My mom, my aunt, my cousins, my
oh,
uncles.
My God. I saw your mom. Remember, I saw your mom at an event late December.
Yep.
Your mom gave me a rum cake.
That she did.
She gave me a rum cake. I took that rum cake home. Stebbit had that rum cake for breakfast.
I saw the video. It was very sweet. Thank you so much. It made her whole.
You made everything. The best rum cake we've ever had in our lives. Thank you so much.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Are you ready to unlock your inner greatness? If so, make sure to listen to my podcast, The School of Greatness, hosted by me, Lewis Howes. Join me as I sit down with world-class performers, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders to uncover their secrets to success with new episodes every single week. Whether you're striving for personal growth, business mastery, or simply seeking inspiration, The School of Greatness has something for you, and you can find it on SiriusXM, Pandora, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Subscribe and follow to the show so you never miss an episode and start your journey to greatness today.
So Fruitvale obviously was a turning point.
Yes. For me, as a man, as an actor, you know, I've always been a part of an ensemble cast. I never had a chance to, you know, you have very talented actors out there that can't open up a movie or can't be the lead of a film. And I really wanted to know what type of actor I was going to be, if I had the ability, if I had the skills to open up a film. And Fruitvale Station was the first one I had a chance to be the lead. And, you know, the success that we had at, you know, at Sundance, and then, you know, critically, it did very well.
And now you and Ryan Coogler have this thing, you know, it's like Aaron Sorkin has Jeff Daniels, and the Coen brothers have Frances McDormand, and you and Ryan have this. What is it? Symbiosis.
Brotherhood.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a brotherhood. I think it's, you know, we're the same age. We're from similar places. You know, he's from Oakland. I'm from Newark, New Jersey. And
What does it feel like to be in his care? Like, you know, he's there directing, and it feels like what?
Confidence.
Okay.
Trust.
Trust, yeah.
You know, being comfortable. You know, being able to, he says, run through this brick wall. You know, I'm going to trust him. I'm going to go for it. You know, it's not going to hurt. Just run through that brick wall. Okay, cool. Let's do it. Because I know he won't put me in a position.
That's good.
That's going to be, you know, that's going to hurt me or damage me in any type of way. We have an understanding of what we're trying to build and what we're trying to do. You know, any movie that I want to do that, you know, that we want to say something, we want to have any type of meaning to it and really, you know, have a message to come across, Ryan's the guy for that, you know? And he's not gonna get into something that he doesn't fully have his heart into.
So that's when it started to take off. And did you say, this is good right here?
I said.
And then along comes Creed, and then Creed 2. What were you saying to yourself?
You wanna be perfectly honest, before we even shot one frame of Fruitvale Station, Ryan already pitched to me Creed 1.
Really?
And was like, hey, do you wanna go shoot this movie about Apollo Creed, son? And I was like, cool, let's do it. And this is before we even started filming Fruitvale Station. So it was that type of trust that we had from the beginning.
That's great.
So it was like, okay, let's do it.
That's also great because I know a lot of actors when they're starting out, particularly, there's this feeling like, will this be my last film? And what will be the next film? And how will I build on this? So you didn't even have that.
I did have that though, because I wasn't.
But you already knew you were gonna work.
But he didn't. Sly didn't even say yes. You know, was one of those things that was in the infancy stages that we didn't. Nothing was guaranteed, and I think that's how I always approach everything. That's nothing's guaranteed, and I gotta treat every situation that I'm in like it could be my last, just because the fear of, you know, lack of opportunity. So I think that's what kind of really got the gears turning towards production and ownership and being able to write and create, so I could be able to control my own destiny a little bit more, you know, not wait on the incoming phone calls.
Yes.
Take a page out your book a little bit.
Thank you. Nice page.
I got you.
In her book, Michelle Obama talks about the intense responsibility she felt as being a part of the first African-American family to occupy the White House. Now, you're not the first Black movie star.
No.
Nope. But you are part of a very elite group. And so I guess I'm wondering if there's a place where race and art intersect for you. Like, do you choose things based upon something bigger than whatever's going on in the moment?
Yes. I think, you know, that's a not a complicated question, but for me, I always found myself being the Trojan horse. I always looked at myself as, like, the guy who could infiltrate and kind of keep the door open, you know, and kind of open it up as much as I can. So there was a time right after Fruitvale Station where I only wanted to go out for roles that was written for white males, you know, Caucasian males. I didn't want anything that in the breakdown, if it came up as African-American, I didn't want to do it because I felt like there was a certain bias, you know, from writers that were writing from what they experienced or what they saw in the news and media. You know, they never really had, contact with, you know, black and brown people. So they were writing from their experiences, which came with a certain bias.
And you wanted to say, I can do it all.
I can do whatever it is.
Yeah.
I want the roles that Leo's playing, that Tom, that, you know, Bradley, we're Cooper in here. You know, Bradley I got time for, you know, that's my guy, you know. And you know, Bradley and Ben and Matt, those are people that kind of took me, you know, in and gave me advice very early. And kind of encouraged me to continue to do the things that I'm doing. So my mind state was like, okay, if I could do a role that was written for them, you know, inherently, of course, me playing the role is going to make it that. It doesn't need to be in a breakdown that it's African-American from X, Y, and Z.
And I'd read that there was also some consideration because when your mother was on the set of Wire and you were killed, that your mom had like a little breakdown thinking it was actually
She's
you.
A crier.
She's a crier.
She's a crier.
Yeah. And so you had decided you were not going to do roles where you're killed anymore, but you are definitely dead as a Killmonger in Black Panther.
I'm definitely dead in that movie, yes.
Yes.
And it's one of those things where it's something that Denzel said. You know, he wanted the audience to view him as somebody that survived at the end of the movie, that was the hero, so they can get used to seeing you as the lead, as the hero character. So I was like, okay, that makes sense. I'm tired of dying. I would love to make it to, like, the end credits. So let's switch it up a little bit. So, mom had a lot to do with that, and Denzel also kind of giving me that little piece of advice that I felt like would help me out in the future.
So even though you died in Ryan...
It was worth it.
It was worth it. And Ryan signed on to do the next version of Black Panther. So will you be resurrected?
I know nothing.
You know nothing.
The crazy thing is, like, everybody assumes me and Ryan are so close that he tells me everything. He keeps things from me. Like, I literally have to, like, trick him into answering certain questions. But he doesn't divulge. He can keep a secret.
Okay.
He can keep a secret.
Would you like to be revived?
I would. I think that would be pretty cool.
I think it's Wakanda. Anything can happen. Okay.
Yeah.
I heard a rumor. There's been this buzz that you're going to be the next Superman.
Yeah, that was a rumor. I heard that. I heard a few rumors buzzing around. I think just to be in those conversations, it's flattering and very humbling that they would like.
Would you like to be Superman?
It's tough. You know why? Because I hate being a businessman also and like understanding both sides of the situation. And I think there's a huge upside to it, but then there's just being under that microscope of just being picked apart and compared to so many different versions of Superman. I would rather do something original.
Really?
But the
chance to be Superman.
I mean, it's cool.
In your skin.
I'll be Calvin Ellis. You know, there's another version of Superman that from Earth 23. I'm a comic book guy.
Okay.
You know, so Calvin Ellis is like, you know, Earth 23.
I don't know who you're talking about, but okay.
So,
and I just had a little moment where I'm like, am I going to act like I know what he's saying? Do I just do that little kind of, oh, yeah, Calvin, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah,
There's another version of Superman in another dimension that is black already in the comic books that exist. And I think the comic book, you know, purists can accept that more than me being, Clark Kent from Kansas. And that's a different thing.
That's a very different thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I read somewhere, and I think this is really important for anybody, that you had said it's more important what you say. Yeah, because we can reuse them.
It's very fancy. Yeah, it is good.
That's very nice.
Metal straws. I'm cool with that.
That you've said that what you say no to is equally as important as what you say yes to. I think that's important for everybody in their life, but in particular in choosing roles, right?
For sure. It's one of those things where, you know, you can't do everything.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to be oversaturated. I don't want everybody to see me, you know, 24/7, 365, you know, year after year. You know, I want to do things that really move the needle in one way. You know, I want to be very, you know, strategic about the moves that I make and the roles that I play because you're immortalized forever. You know, once you get in front of that camera, you know, and you shoot a film, that's something that people can, you know, go back to and dissect over and over again. So you want to do things that you're proud of and you really, you know, you have skin in the game.
Let's talk about the day the nominations came out, and Black Panther, with its $1.3 billion grossing around the world, which has changed everything, you know? people said people wouldn't watch films in different parts of the world, and then you see people in all over the world who are lined up for that film. How are you feeling then, first of all? And then we'll get to the...
When
people were lined up. You saw what was happening.
It was insane.
People were dressing up. They thought they were from Wakanda. Everybody thought they were from Wakanda. Yeah.
No, I mean, I think it was crazy to see, like, all the memes and the videos, the home videos from the fans at home, and just everybody, like, you know, with their permanent marker Killmonger beards and the wigs and stuff like that. I felt inspired. I felt like I was really a part of something special that was a lot bigger than me, you know? It was a lot bigger than the movie itself. It was giving kids and generations a chance to dream again, you know, dream.
Not even again, just to see yourself in a way that you never even imagined.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. So for me, the whole Black Panther movement before, you know, before the box office numbers and all that good stuff was just anxiety, nervous, proud. When will it end? When is it going to stop? You know,
But when you all were on set doing it, I mean, I just saw you all get the Screen Actors Guild the other day as an ensemble. Y'all look so happy and so good up there.
Because it's like being with your family all over
again.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. When you're doing it...
We got to move Andy closer.
Yes.
We got to move Andy closer.
Hey, when you're doing it, do you know that this is going to be as big as it is? Do you feel something energetically? Like, this is different than other stuff?
We felt like we had all the pieces needed to do something special. And if we did our job every day and we didn't take it for granted that we could do something special. But there's no way that we could have assumed that it was going to do what
it's
done
so
far. No, not at all. No. We were just making sure that we took care of the opportunity. You know, that we thought about, if this doesn't work, when will there be another one? If we don't do this right, we can't mess this up. I think that was kind of the thing that really drove me personally, and I know some of the other, you know, other actors as well kind of thought about a lot. It's like, we can't mess this up.
Are you ready to unlock your inner greatness? If so, make sure to listen to my podcast, The School of Greatness, hosted by me, Lewis Howes. Join me as I sit down with world-class performers, entrepreneurs, and thought leaders to uncover their secrets to success, with new episodes every single week. Whether you're striving for personal growth, business mastery, or simply seeking inspiration, The School of Greatness has something for you, and you can find it on SiriusXM, Pandora, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Subscribe and follow to the show so you never miss an episode, and start your journey to greatness today.
So this is the first time you're in a film that's nominated for Best Picture.
Yes, ma'am.
Does that feel different? Does the actual acknowledgement from the Academy, what does that mean?
I think, of course, you know, if you're an actor, if you're in our industry, you know, obviously being able to get nominated for an Oscar is on the list of things that you want. You know, it would be amazing to grab that. I think with this movie in particular, with the cast that we have and the impact that it's made culturally, that it's already won. You know,
I think it won for the kids,
box office, what it's doing to the industry as far as the way people think about films moving forward, especially people of color. You know, and it won then. So now this is like the icing on the cake. You know, now it's everybody else is putting the pressure on us of how it feels, and we're really happy and excited that we've come this far.
Yeah.
You know, the acknowledgement, of course, would be cool, but, you know, I think we've already won.
Okay, so you're going, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
You already know what you're wearing.
Figuring it out.
Yep. Who are you taking as a date?
I don't know yet. I think it's like a perfect moment. Ma, you want to go with me? I haven't even talked about it. Ma, you want to go? Done. There it is.
Done.
That's my date. Yeah. That's cool.
I would just think that it would be pretty hard for you to date about now, being you at this point.
Why do we always gotta get here?
We gotta.
Oh, man.
We gotta.
It is hard.
We gotta get here. Otherwise, people will say, I did not do my job. But how do you find someone who can step into this ride with you at this particular time?
That's a great question. I don't know how.
You need a nice church girl.
I need a good church girl. I don't know what I need, honestly. You know, it's Aunt Ramona, what do we need? What do we need? What am I looking for? I don't know. I think for me, it's hopefully she'll reveal herself when I'm ready for that.
Yes, that's you what know? Will happen. But here's the thing. You're turning 32 this week, and I remember... we're not going to stay on that long. Everybody wants to know. Okay. No. So I remember so well turning 32 because it's the year we launched the Oprah show that it went national.
Okay.
And my life took off like a rocket. And here's the thing, you know this, that when you're riding the rocket, life becomes like a blur.
Yes.
That you literally don't even know where you're going. I remember so many days that I wouldn't read the itinerary till I came home because to read it before it would like
give you so much.
Yeah,
you wouldn't stop working.
Yeah. I just go where the people tell me to go. Mm-hmm. So you're on that rocket right now. How do you keep things from blurring and keep from not going numb to things around you? Okay. Because I can look back now on my life and think there's so many things that happened. I don't even remember I was there. I can see a tape and say, it looks like me.
People are telling you about moments and you're like, yeah. That sounds
especially
about right.
People who say, Oprah, remember me.
Oh, man, that's so tough. Like, please don't put that pressure on me. I'm so sorry. Like, yes. I can't.
And then when they say, what's my name?
Yeah.
Then I say,
that's why I always go, it's a pleasure to see you again, instead of nice to meet you.
I just go, woo, that's you.
See, I don't think anybody...
Woo, look at you.
But nobody will ever call her out.
Look at you.
I haven't gotten there yet.
You haven't gotten there yet?
No, because nobody's going to call you out. They'll still call me out.
I do get called out. Like, remember me, what's my name? I think that's so rude, by the way.
It is. Yeah. It's a little unfair for us.
It's enough if we're acting like we know you, so just take that. Take that. Just be gracious. Take that. Instead of, what's my name? Okay. So the question is, how do you, in the midst of all this, are you working on, and I would say, I wish I had done more work at the time on centering and taking it in, because so much of it is a blur. So what are you doing now to manage that for yourself?
It's the meditation. It's the spiritual kind of connection that you have to be able to ground yourself and center yourself, that you're protected moving in these spaces that are constantly taking things from you, your energy, just that's draining throughout your life. So when I am on the road, and this is something that I need to work on, and I need to do it more often because things are getting a little bit more intense for me.
That gets blurred.
Because you said it perfectly. You're going from one place to another. You know, people are, pushing you here, answer this question.
And you're coming in the back door. You don't even know what hotel you're in. You have to get up and ask, look at the phone.
Sometimes you just walk into a room and you're like, oh, this is what we're doing. Hey, what's up, guys?
Yeah.
And you're on again. So I think just finding moments to center yourself, to ground yourself, to kind of
connect. You said meditation, so does that mean you, like, actually,
meditation has a lot of baggage to it. I think there's a lot of, stereotypical, you're sitting there, legs crossed, incense burning, but you are setting a scene and creating an environment for energy to come to you.
Yeah.
And for you to kind of center yourself. So you are, taking deep breaths. You are holding thoughts of what you want to happen. You are sending your energy out into the universe to take care of whatever needs to take care of. So when you physically walk into that space, it's already done.
Yeah.
I'm still a baby at, and I'm still learning, but I've surrounded myself and have family and friends, that believe in that protect me, that pray for me.
I was just going to ask the prayer question. Are you a prayer more or a meditator?
Both. I think it goes hand in hand.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think hand in hand. So I think it's prayer and meditation. It's both.
And do you think that you live the life that you do because you've been prayed up?
1,000%.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with... And that's why when I think sometimes I get uncomfortable, or I'm still learning how to take a lot of compliments and appreciation for things that I do, because I'm just the vessel for a lot of things. And I realize that I got to stay out my own way and kind of stick to what I'm doing. So when people say, they give me a lot of compliments, and it's like, cool, but I try not to really listen or just feed into it that much, because I know it's just a lot bigger than that.
Because it's so hard when you are on the rise and you're surrounded by everybody who says yes to you and just wants to know, do you want sparkling or flat or water? Yeah, where everybody's just like, what can I get you? What can I get you?
Yes,
it's hard to stay centered. So I would say this, my assessment of you, having watched you, is that you are a young man who we can see has been raised well. You've been raised well. Mm. So what is the lesson? I see your mama going, yes, I did.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So what is the number one lesson from your parents or the lessons that stuck? I know it's not one thing, but what is the essence of it? Like how you were raised that allows you to be at 32 to stand inside yourself the way you do?
It's a great question. I think my parents are very different, but very much so the same. Mm-hmm. So I think from my dad, I kind of always gotten the life lesson of, at a very young age, you have to find something you're serious about, something you care about, something you're passionate about, and take it seriously. Just find something and take it seriously. Put the time and the effort. That's where I get a lot of my work ethic from. Mm-hmm. I seen him go to work, you know, work nights. You know, when I'm going to school, he's like, you know, either passed out, trying to like, you know, wake up on the couch to see me off, or, you know, he's asleep. By the time I get home, he's going out to work. Like, I've seen him put the time in, and I know what it takes. I know what goes into, you know, being a man and being a tip of the spear of a household. Mm-hmm. And I've also seen, so I think that's what I kind of got, like, you know, from my dad. That's a lesson that I take with me to everything that I do.
You know, the work ethic.
It's the work ethic.
Okay.
Find something that you're serious about and be serious about it, you know, and really, you know, hone your craft.
Right.
Or your lane and your business or whatever it is. And that's kind of where I got my work ethic from. I think my mom is her heart, is the humanity, my ability to feel. I'm an empath. You know what I'm saying? So I think the ability to feel people and interact with energies and finesse and just navigate that is a lesson that I'm constantly learning and trying to, you know, get better at. But I think I get that from my mom for sure, is that, you know, pulling on emotions, you know, I think it helps me out a lot with my acting. I think it helps a lot with me as a person, you know, just trying to be genuine to the universe, man, and to people. You know, we're all living here and just trying to, you know, I know it's going to come back to me, you know, in a way.
Yeah, that's my religion, is the third law of motion. What you put out is coming back.
Exactly.
I live my life that way. What is the defining value system that you hold for how you lead your life?
That you're going to get you're going to get back what you put out.
Mm-hmm.
And as broad and vague as that is, I think it's very specific to a lot of things that you do throughout your life. You know, I think when it comes to business, when it comes to personal relationships, when it comes to yourself, you know, what you put into yourself is what you're going to get out. You know,
so do you work on giving yourself good stuff? What do you feed yourself spiritually, emotionally?
I've always put myself last, and that's what I'm working on, honestly.
Really?
I'm working on taking care of myself now because I think I've gotten by on youth and pure energy.
And your dimples.
Maybe dimples, maybe I got by with them too.
Dimples are working for you.
for a while now. I think I need to start reinvesting in myself more and taking time for me. I've always, you know, in your mind is like, when I get to this point, I'll start working on myself. Or when I get to that point, and you just always keep going because you don't want things to stop. Or you remember a time where, you know, you weren't getting the incoming phone calls and you were sitting at home, you know, not knowing what to do. So I think I've been in this kind of cycle of, I got to keep working. I can't stop. I can't stop. I can't stop.
So, are you there? But aren't you like, didn't I just read, you just did a deal with Amazon. You just did a deal with Warner Brothers. Everybody's knocking on your door. Knock, knock, knock.
I feel like I'm almost there. I put down certain things in place. Like I saw it already. I've seen it a couple years ago. So I'm like, okay, I need this in place. I need that in place. I need this in place.
Do you have like a physical vision board, or do you physically have a vision for where you want to go?
Both.
Yeah.
I daydream all the time. You know, I'm always daydreaming. You got to see it first. I got to see the steps.
Yeah.
So I like seeing where I want to go, and then reverse engineering the steps how to get there. And of course, things are going to change, and you know, you adapt to, you know, life and things that come at you.
Did you see yourself in a $1.3 billion movie?
I didn't, but I saw myself in a superhero film and a film that had impact.
You did?
You know, I did. I always told I think it might have been like right around 2013 or so. I, I said I wanted to be Black Panther, you know, because I was the only character that I knew that was like Black, and I was like, man, I want to play Black Panther one day. That was what I saw. That's what I told myself. Now I wasn't Black Panther, but I was in Black Panther.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So like things are gonna change from how you see it, but.
And isn't it fun playing the villain?
Isn't it fun? Yeah. It is. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
Where did you go to get all that nastiness?
I was by myself. I isolated myself. I spent a lot of time alone because I figured Eric, you know, his childhood growing up was pretty lonely.
Yeah.
He didn't have a lot of people that he could talk to about this place called Wakanda that, you know, didn't exist. But he was told these stories. It's kind of similar to, I don't know, the stories that I was told as a kid, you know, about Africa and how it was. But I haven't been there. My parents haven't been there. Not at the time. So who knows that this place even exists or... You know, that's not what we're being taught in history books at school. It's not what we're being taught anywhere. So how do I know this place really exists? So for Eric, you know, he had to keep all of this information into himself until he kind of planned. And of course, it's an extreme, exaggerated version of, you know, the African diaspora from the African American perspective. So to be able to take that kind of pain and rage and all those emotions that Eric kind of represents from being Black and brown here in America, I was able to kind of put that, you know, into a character and put it on screen. So that's something that I didn't take lightly, and I didn't have a process. I'm not like one of these, you know, some people are methods, certain people are this or that. I just did whatever I felt I needed to do or whatever I felt was right in the moment every step of the way. So it was no real plan. I didn't have an escape plan either. So, really? Like, every day was just going into this place, and I just tried to stay there as long as I could. And then when it was all over, I think just being in that kind of, that mind state, that real unapologetic, you know, just real, like, you know, whatever all the time, kind of kept, it caught up with me, and I got a little, you know, a little depressed. It was tough for me for a minute, you know?
Really?
Just readjusting to being around the people that care about me, getting that love that I shut out for a long time. Like, I shut out love. I didn't want love and affection. You know, I wanted to be in this lonely place as long as I could in order to kind of capture the essence of what Eric, you know, Stevens was, what Killmonger was. So when we wrapped the film, you know, I'm like, in my mind, I was like, okay, cool, go back to, you know, regular life, get back to L.A., be cool. But it was a little tough for me at first to kind of, like, accept that
love. It was hard
just
to lay him down.
Yeah.
And be done with it.
Yeah.
Did it take you a while?
It took me, you know, I mean, I don't really know exactly when I came out of it, but, you know, I went to therapy, you know what I'm saying? I started talking to people, started unpacking a little bit.
I find that so interesting because I think the body doesn't know the difference. I remember having this conversation with a famous actor once about Anthony Hopkins. I was saying, Anthony Hopkins, I feel for you because... you know, all the stuff you're taking in, you do so well. And he said, I used to not think about it, but as I've gotten older, I do think about it, because he was saying that he had just done a film and he had said to the director he was going to do one wide shot and one close-up because he had to have a heart attack because he didn't want to put his body in that state too many times.
Yes.
Because your body doesn't know the difference when you get yourself into that state. And so that's why I think it's interesting for people to hear that even though you're playing this character, sometimes the essence of that, the energy of that still remains.
1,000%.
Still remains.
And like your mind is so powerful, your mind will get your body past a threshold that it would have given up on way before. Like you're like there were moments where physically I probably shouldn't have continued, but my mind was like, no, we're almost to the finish line. You gotta get it past that. You gotta get past that line. But as soon as I got past that line, my body said, okay, we can shut down now.
Yeah.
And then it would shut down after that. So I think honestly, therapy, just talking to somebody was something that really helped me out a lot. And as a man, I think, you know, we get a lot of slack for it of, you know, not, you know, I don't even talk to nobody, you know what I'm saying? That whole, you know, what it is to be a man, being masculine, you know, like that. You know, that doesn't, I don't really subscribe to that because I feel like everybody needs to unpack and talk, you know, whether it's, you know, at a therapist or it's, you know, a close friend or a family member or somebody.
That's good.
Because mental illness is real, you know, and it's a real thing.
So you've named your company Outlier.
Yes, ma'am.
Why?
After one of my mentors, I mean, I don't even know if he knows he's a mentor, but I kind of look up Malcolm Gladwell's Outliers.
Of course.
You know, like, it's one of his third.
I love that book.
Yeah, it's awesome to me. And what he thought went into success.
The 10,000 hours.
Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was almost 10,000. It was almost 10,000 hours society, but it just didn't come off right.
Yeah.
Outlaw society sounded better. But that's where, you know, I kind of got the name from, because I didn't want to be put in a box. I didn't want to be stereotyped. I wanted to go against the grain. I wanted to represent the people that felt like they were outsiders, like they were outliers. So I kind of wanted to create a society.
But it doesn't mean you feel like you're an outlier, or does it?
Oh, I'm an outlier.
Definitely.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so I wanted to create a society of, you know, like-minded individuals.
So your company incorporated one of the first, actually, inclusion riders used in the industry. Mm-hmm. Explain what an inclusion rider is to the audience and how that works and why you did it.
An inclusion rider is pretty much a tool. Well, historically in TV and film, you know, people of color, women, people from, you know, the LGBTQ community are underrepresented. You know, they don't really have a lot of opportunities in front of the camera and behind the camera. So, you know, in Hollywood, people are used to hiring with people, you know, hire people that you know, people that you've worked with before, you know, people that you have a connection with. You know, it's a cycle, and more often than not, that circle, those people that you that are often being
they look
cast
like you.
Again, they don't look like me. They yeah. they look like them.
They
exactly.
look like you. Hire the people that look like you.
Disproportionately, yeah. you know, white yeah. and straight and male. You know, that's yeah. that's kind of the world that we live in. So when I heard Fran kind of come up with the inclusion ride, I was sitting at home like, well, I was actually at the Oscars that year, and I was like, wow, there's a title for it. There's a tool. There's a policy that could be put into place. And I was like, oh, immediately we have to do that. We have to include that in outliers, you know, non-negotiable, you know, moving forward.
Which means
that my partners are going to have, you know, it's a tool that holds people accountable, that constantly reminds them of this.
That you're not gonna have a company where people say, we couldn't find anybody.
Exactly. You're constantly reminding people of the pool of talent that are underrepresented, like women, people of color, people from the LGBTQ.
Which means you gotta work harder every time.
1,000%. So any partner that I work with, so Warner Brothers, I've collaborated with Warner Brothers to help, with Warner Media, to help write their inclusion policy for all of Warner Media, and that's a huge win. Because I feel like, huge first step. And I feel like it made it, their first money in. You know, any of these big companies and these big corporations, nobody wants to be the first to do anything. But when you have arguably the number one studio in the world say that we're backing behind this vision, you know, you'll see other studios and production companies kind of fall
in line. Now, you can do anything you want. This is the moment. Because everybody's like, Michael says that we should have an inclusion writer.
Yes. And kudos to Amazon for willingly in open arms, you know, welcoming, you know, Outlier Society and our inclusion writer also in that deal. So my TV first look deal is at Amazon, and they've accepted that as well. So
pretty cool. Pretty cool. So you know what I'm really excited about? The trajectory of your life is astounding right now, and you are playing a role. Next year, I think it's coming out.
Hopefully,
Just Mercy. What do you mean?
Just Mercy. No, not hopefully, but meaning like, you know how it is with dates and, you know, other films
hopefully,
coming out.
Hopefully, I got to date.
It's coming out.
2020, okay? All right?
Yes, ma'am. Open those things that I don't know. Okay. She knows it all.
So it's Just Mercy. Have y'all heard, you've heard of the book? If you haven't, it's one of those books that as an American citizen, you have to read. It's based on the life of defense attorney Brian Stevenson. And it's a book that I think as every human being should read, but particularly if you're an American, because it flips everything you thought you believed about the criminal justice system and criminals. Brian has dedicated his life to providing free legal representation to inmates who may have been wrongly convicted or denied a fair trial.
Yes.
Okay, so you're playing him.
I am. Set in the late 80s, early 90s.
And Jamie Foxx is playing.
Is playing the falsely
accused. The inmate
accused,
who's falsely accused.
Yeah, yeah, that I'm
and
trying to get off.
Trying to defend
and
him.
I'm trying to defend him. Yeah, Brie Larson plays, you know, a colleague, a coworker that kind of helped Brian's vision kind of come to fruition. So it's an incredible cast.
So is it a different kind of challenge to play somebody who is a real life person and still very much alive?
Yes.
Yeah.
The pressure I put on myself to play this person that is so beloved,
yeah,
that is, nobody's perfect, but man, this
he's
guy
pretty
is
close.
Pretty close,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
So I think after meeting the guy and seeing how he was and how everybody kind of, you know, really looked up to him and the impact that he made, I was a little nervous about this one, honestly, getting it right. Cause I just wanted to get it right, honestly. So I spent a lot of time with him
At EGI, down at the Eagle Justice Institute.
Yep, down in Alabama, in the museum.
And have you seen the museum?
The museum's incredible, and I encourage everybody to go.
If you haven't seen the museum, where it's called the Peace and Justice Memorial, mm-hmm. where they have all of these hanging still rods from the ceiling that has the name of every black person lynched.
In that county.
In that particular county.
And they're encouraging, the mayors of that county to claim their memorial, to bring it out, because we haven't had that, America hasn't had that closure, that we haven't had that healing process done here yet. And Brian's ideology behind that is,
you can't heal what you don't acknowledge.
Exactly. And until we're acknowledging the dirty, deep past that we've had, we can't move forward. Yeah. So that's another reason why I really wanted to get behind this project and play him, to be able to give the story some light. It needs to be seen.
We're looking forward to that January 2020. Okay. Now, here's the deal. World domination. What does that really look like for you? I always believe that every human being is looking for the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's one of the reasons why I always felt such a connection to my audience, because even as my life progressed and, I was, wearing better shoes, my feet were still on the ground, because I understood that every human being is looking to fulfill the truest, highest expression of themselves as a human being. And you're doing that if you're a doctor, lawyer, if you're a fireman, if you're a clerk, you're looking to fulfill the truest, highest version of yourself as a human being. Mm-hmm. What's that gonna look like for you, the truest, highest version?
I'm still working on it, because that work I was telling you, I kept putting myself last.
Yeah.
I wanna start defining exactly who that person is. Mm-hmm. And I think, the goals have been constantly changing for me and evolving. World domination, it's a broad goal that I want to have, but I don't really know.
But you do recognize this. May I say this to your 32-year-old self?
What?
That it isn't the thing that you're looking for, because if something terrible were to happen to you today, your life would already have had meaning and purpose. It's not like purpose is coming. Purpose is already here. You've already defined purpose by the way you've lived your life. Mm-hmm. So there's more purpose, but you already have purpose.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Just letting you know.
But I guess at 32, it's like, I guess, world domination for me is, I guess, all of the things that I want to have happen and all the future things that I haven't even thought of yet.
Yeah.
I enjoy creating things and putting other people on. I like seeing the good in people. I like seeing people's strengths and be like, how can I maximize that? Where should you go? How can I give you a vehicle or a lane in order for you to go be the best version of yourself? I enjoy that selfishly.
Yeah. The hardest part is going to be surrounding yourself with people who not only share the vision, but can also execute the vision.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, right?
Trial and error. I'm going through it.
You're going through
it. Yes, ma'am.
I know what that's like.
Yeah.
Listen, I wish you the best.
Thank you.
Stay humble, ride this wave. Thank you, Michael B. Jordan. Thank you. Michael B. Jordan!
I'm Oprah Winfrey, and you've been listening to Super Soul Conversations, the podcast. You can follow Super Soul on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Join me next week for another Super Soul Conversation. Thank you for listening.